Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Policy Agendas podcast. I'm EJ Fagan. Today, my co-host is our wonderful research assistant, Emily Wen.
Hi.
Emily, thank you. Thank you for joining us. We're recording at the Southern Political Science Association conference today, and we're recording a lot of episodes at the conference, and so we invited Emily to come on here and fill in for one of our normal graduate students. She's about to leave us for greener pastures. We are joined today by Christina Miller, Associate Professor of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland and author of the book Poor Representation, Congress and the Politics of Poverty in the United States. Christina, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're really excited to discuss this book. You know, this is our fourth episode of the podcast, and this is the first episode where we've really gone into the policy agendas world. And this is a really innovative use of the data that we produce here. And so that's really what we're excited to talk about. But I'm wondering if, before we kind of get to that, if you can talk about the argument of the book and why you wrote it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the policy agendas data is a huge part of what brings the project together and unites, you know, a lot of the data in the chapters. So I'm very grateful for having the data and being able to use it. So the project in general and the book kind of came out of a sense that there's been an increase in attention to inequality, both more broadly and also in political science. But we tend to talk about things like the 99% versus the 1%. Or the super rich. Sometimes we talk about the middle class as well, but I think it was pretty striking to me how infrequently we talk about the poor. So for me, the book kind of has two main questions. The first is, are the poor represented in Congress? And then, how does that occur? And so those are the two things I'm really looking to understand. And for me, this was an important question that I wanted to ask. There's kind of the obvious impact in that generally, there's agreement that we would like to alleviate poverty as best as possible. And so that's kind of a real world reason that this question is important, to try to understand how we can better do that. And then also thinking about it from a policymaking perspective about who's being included, whose voices are there. If we're trying to make good public policy, we want to have more ideas rather than fewer ideas. And so, you know, trying to get into that as well. And then normatively, as a representative democracy, we would like, you know, to have those who are affected by decisions be part of it and to address the needs of all constituents. So those were some of the things I had in mind coming to the project. In terms of kind of the actual academic part of it, there's a lot of great work on poverty, and there's a lot of great work on Congress, but it's not so often that the two come together. And so that was a place that I was hoping to contribute to with this book. And there's other work there, but I think it's a smaller piece of what we know. And I'm very interested in the representation part of it. So thinking about, you know, who's doing what for whom. And particular, which legislators are active for the poor. So kind of three things I was really interested in is, first, thinking really about interests rather than the opinions of the poor. And that's a place where the Policy Agendas Project data is huge. And I know we're going to get more into that. Also thinking about kind of different stages in the legislative process. So not just the outcomes, but the bills sponsored, the hearings held, all those types of things. And then also thinking about the different types of representation that we have in political science, but kind of bringing them all together. So thinking about Congress as a whole, thinking about members in their own district, and then thinking about this surrogate representation that I end up kind of coming around to in the course of the book. So I can get more in, keep
sure,
going?
Sure, let's talk a little bit about that. Okay. Data. So most of the studies of representation of the poor, I'm thinking of much of the work of Larry Bartels, Martin Gillens, is focusing on the poor's preferences in a public opinion setting. So what do you gain by moving to elites, to look at elite representation, and then how do you actually measure what elites are doing to represent the poor?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, there's some great work, Bartels and Gillens, but, you know, and also some other work out there that focuses on the representation of opinions or expressed preferences. And I think in part this reflects the broader kind of two schools of thought in the discipline in representation in general, right? We've got kind of a representation of opinions school of thought and then a representation of interests. And so, you know, just thinking about the congressional literature, you can kind of see examples of both. So in part because there's already great work looking at opinion and preferences more, and in part reflecting my own sense of representation and the importance of representing interests. One of the things I really like about looking at interests, and here I'm thinking about kind of what are the policies, what are the ways in which government could act that affect the daily lives of people. And I think one of the really nice things about approaching representation as interests is that it doesn't require there to always be an opinion there. So it's easier to see, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's easier to see non-events because you can identify it and then you know if something doesn't happen, which is always a challenge in political sciences, those non-events. One of the other things is that I think that it is a realistic way to anticipate how legislators represent because it's really hard for them to stay on top of all the variations in public opinion. Public opinion can also change. Scholars have raised concern about the level of information when we get into certain types of specific public opinion. And so this is a way that I think is realistic to imagine that a member of Congress and their staff can really think about addressing the needs of who they represent. And so those are some of the reasons I went with representation of interests.
And so what you did was you defined a I should speak to everybody else out there. You know what you did. You defined a set of subtopics within the Policy Agendas Project Codebook as poverty-related issues. And there's a lot of interesting subtopics in there. Some are very specific to the poor, and those are no-brainers. I'm curious why you decided to include subtopics that are closer to just kind of broad economic issues for other people. So our general macroeconomic subtopic, our unemployment rate subtopic, our job training subtopic, et cetera. Are these poverty issues that are the interests of the poor, or are they interests that maybe are more of the poor than other people, but still kind of other people?
Yeah, so this hits, I think, it's a really good question, and something I thought a lot about in the course of the project, in that trying to define the interests of the poor, obviously I was going to look at the social welfare codes and things we normally think about, but it was really important to me to broaden out how we define the interests of the poor, both because I wanted to get as inclusive a measure as possible, but also because I want to acknowledge that different legislators may have different approaches to alleviating poverty. And so for some, predominantly for Democrats or liberals, we'll see it in some of the codes that reflect social welfare programs in the traditional sense. But it's also very possible that a Republican or a more conservative or free market-oriented legislator is also trying to address poverty, but doing it through through jobs, right? Or through providing tax incentives for landlords to build rent-controlled housing or things of that sort. And so I wanted to be able to include all of that. So that's one of the reasons that, in addition to the kind of standard things, the set of social welfare codes, I also expanded out, like you mentioned, to look at things like the employment training and workforce development subcodes, and I think as well as some of the macroeconomic codes. But your question also kind of gets at this decision that I made about whether to focus on targeted programs or more general programs. And so some of the work on policy addressing the poor makes the argument that universal programs are a really important piece of the puzzle. So, say, Social Security, that as we lift everybody, the poor are also helped. And I agree with that completely. But for my specific questions, where I'm really looking at how members of Congress represent the poor and who's taking up the cause, that to me wasn't as good of a match. Because if you see a legislator sponsoring, you know, legislation to improve or increase Social Security, I think it would be tricky to say they're doing that to help the poor. And so I wanted to stay narrow enough such that I could say that when you act on these types of issues, it is with the poor in mind.
If someone like, say, the President of the United States decides to act on immigration issues and says that he's representing the poor, is he representing the poor in that sense? I mean, can you represent only some of the poor? Can you represent the poor in ways that aren't addressing poverty? Is a hawkish foreign policy in some way representing the poor?
So I definitely think that you can represent or take actions that help some types of poor people more than other types of poor people. And certainly in the research that I do in this book, and more generally, I would argue that that should be, you know, quote unquote, counted. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, there's a place for these targeted programs. And so some things are going to be helping the urban poor more. Some might be targeting access in rural areas. And I think all of that, you know, counts, certainly. I'm sorry, I lost the second question there.
I guess the better question is anti-poverty specifically the overriding priority of the poor? I mean, do the poor maybe have different preferences for cultural issues or foreign policy issues or other issues that you are represented from that district, and we're going to transition to that after this, mm-hmm. might want to emphasize because that's what their constituents emphasize?
Yeah, no, I think that that is part of the story, but I think that when we're talking about Americans living in poverty, addressing that day-to-day difficulty is a top priority. It doesn't mean that they don't also perhaps have an interest or preferences on issues of international relations and you know, kind of broader policies. But I think, you know, if we all think about our own lives, we are very familiar with our day-to-day troubles and with how we interact with government in a very personal way. And so I think that's definitely part of how the poor see politics and government. But I agree with a broader point that that is not all that they can engage in terms of political engagement and preferences. But I think it's a very important and immediate part of that.
I'd like to transition to talking about representation, and Emily's going to ask most of these questions. But first, I'd just like you to explain, I think, the most important and by far the most shocking, I think, finding of your book, which is that dyadic representation tends to break down for representing impoverished districts. So can you explain what you found there, and then we'll move on to some more specific questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So after looking at kind of collective representation, which we can get to if we want to, but the dyadic, I was really interested in this kind of quintessential relationship, right? Is does your legislator act on behalf of you, right? Do you have a voice there? And so what I looked at here was I looked at all members of the House going back to the early 1980s, and I looked specifically at bill sponsorship and then also at voting, but I'll talk mostly about the bill sponsorship. And so using the policy agenda's data, I was able to devise a count for every member for every single one of those 30-some-odd years as to how many poverty-related bills they sponsored. And again, that encompasses a wide range. And what theoretically I anticipated finding given the literature is that as you have more of one type of constituent, you should be more active. So even if overall levels of activity in Congress on poverty are pretty low, you know, there is some movement, and I would expect that the people that are sponsoring poverty-related legislation should come from more poor districts. So, right, we think about this, you know, say, for instance, if you have more farmers in your district, you expect that legislator to sponsor more ag bills. And that is not what I find. And I shake it every which way and turn it upside down. You know, I look at, do you sponsor legislation at all? How many bills do you sponsor? I look at kind of serious legislation. So do you sponsor bills that go to, that are referred to a committee on which you sit? No matter how I do this, there is not a relationship between poverty in the district and legislative activity on poverty issues. So what this means is that a legislator with, you know, 2 or 3% poverty in the district and a legislator with 20% poverty in the district, they look the same. Their activity levels are indistinguishable from one another. And I control for a host of other factors in looking at this. So both race and gender and party of the legislator, I control for district factors, so overall economic conditions and for national trends. And again, this non-finding just keeps sticking. Now, this was the thing that I was not happy to find, neither normatively or also because null findings are kind of tricky in political science. But nevertheless, it was there. And so although members from poor districts are not more active, I did find some patterns in terms of the types of legislators that are more likely to sponsor legislation related to poverty issues. And so these tended to be Democrats. It tended to be African-American legislators, female legislators, and also from urban districts. And so then I kind of pivot to thinking more about who is active, why is that? And that's where I get into this notion of, if it's not dyadic representation, what is it? And so I come to the surrogate representation part of this, which is the idea that you represent constituents who are not in your district. And, you know, we think about this, I think, most commonly with race and gender, that a minority constituent who has, say, a white member in their district but may feel represented by a minority legislator who technically represents a different district. And so the poor also have this type of surrogate representation.
Or Puerto Rico gets represented by the Puerto Rican districts in New York City.
That's right. Yeah.
So Emily was going to ask you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I thought the theme of surrogate representation was really interesting in the book. And what I wanted to know is, what do you think motivates surrogate representatives to advocate for the poor? And how do you reconcile that with the obligations they have to their own districts, which might not be as poverty dense?
Yeah, those are really good questions. So in part, what I think motivates these surrogate representatives, for many of them, I think that there is, I kind of talk about these overlapping needs. So for some of the female legislators, what I find is that the type of poverty legislation they propose tends to have a gendered lens to it. And so I think partially they come to these issues as surrogates for the poor, but because it also overlaps with their role as descriptive representatives and as female legislators, I think that reinforces their activity. And I think the same dynamic also occurs for African-American legislators. There are substantive overlaps in what we would consider perhaps African-American issues and in poverty issues. And so those overlaps help support surrogate representation of the poor. But I also think that some of it is that legislators just carry their own beliefs about this, that this is something that they want to be active on, and that they are committed to. And I think, you know, in an ideal world, you know, it would be great to have really rich data on kind of their own personal experiences and see how that filters in. You know, we have a sense that people's personal experience shapes who they are as legislators. We think about those personal roots of representation. But obviously that type of data is really hard to come by. So that's only my speculations about it from kind of reading and looking at the particular cases, but it's not something I have systematically.
Do you think that surrogate representatives see themselves as advocates for the poor, or do you think they see themselves more as advocating on the intersectional issues that might relate strongly to their district as opposed to being an advocate for the poor?
That's a really good question. I think it varies. I'm thinking about these what I call champions of the poor that are the surrogate representatives. I think you have a little bit of both in there. And so for some, I do think that intersection or overlapping, I know those are qualitatively different terms, and I'm using them somewhat interchangeably here. I do think that is an important part of it. And in a very, so they might not as much focus on their role as representatives of the poor, despite that behaviorally that's what they're doing. One of the things with surrogate representation that's tricky is that there's no electoral accountability in that relationship. And so Jane Mansbridge has written a lot about these different forms of representation, and she tackles this issue in her writings. And one of the things that can help reinforce what is otherwise kind of a vulnerable form of representation is some type of shared identity. So when she's thinking about surrogate representation of African Americans or minorities or women, one of the things that helps to buttress that relationship and that commitment as a representative is a shared identity. And for the poor, that's less likely because there are not very many poor members of Congress, as other studies have shown us. So I do think that common identity on these other dimensions does help buttress the surrogate role. And to your earlier question about, you know, what does this mean for these representatives? Does it come at a cost with their representation of their district? I think that for most of these legislators, that's not, they would not see it that way. And if we think about legislators taking the lead on certain issues and kind of developing reputations on certain issues, I think that they are, that prioritization of poverty issues is something that they're able to balance with their commitments to their districts. And some of these legislators do come from relatively wealthy districts, but they may find support even in their home constituents for their activity on poverty issues.
Absolutely. What I really appreciated about the book was that you really took a lot of different approaches to find any kind of representation for the poor. So if I'm a poverty advocate, what strategy do you suggest to best advance poor issues, whether it be from a lobbying kind of standpoint or through a legislative process of just getting issues either on the agenda or successfully passed through legislation?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think I have a couple of answers. Probably the least grandiose would be for the organizations and advocates that are already out there to think broadly about who might be the most advantageous legislators to work with. Because, you know, convention would be, oh, people who represent high poverty districts. But as I show, that's not necessarily the case. And so I think that's a really important part, both for the actual lobbyists and practitioners, but also for those of us who study interest groups and study that question of kind of who do you lobby and who are you partnering with on Capitol Hill, to recognize that there may be kind of unexpected partners, I guess I would say. I think one of the other, so then kind of staying in the interest group community, but maybe getting a little bit grander in aspiration, would be to increase the number of groups working on behalf of the poor. I do think, and previous scholars have noted as well, is that it's a pretty, there are some great organizations out there, but there's not a lot of organizations out there. And so I do think that that having more advocates for the poor in the greater policymaking community is really important to calling attention to these issues. Also to being able to say, here's some proposals, here, let us work with you to bring these ideas to fruition, or at least to have them as part of the conversation. And that's a place where not just interest groups, but also think tanks, you know, producing more policy papers that legislators who want to be active on this could then use to kind of subsidize their activities in that way would be an important part of this as well. Yeah, so I think those are two ways in thinking about kind of the organized interests as to how we might be able to help increase this.
Great. I think I'll pass it back on to EJ.
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned think tanks, just because it's, you know, I'm an academic. I want to talk about my own work. Democratic think tanks are heavily involved on these issues, on poverty issues. So I've measured their policy agenda using very similar methods, and social welfare policy is by far the biggest issue for progressive think tanks, and many of the other topics that you'd identify as poverty issues are up there, and less so for Republican think tanks. And Republican think tanks, although you find in your work that Republicans aren't trying to sabotage poverty, they're not trying to make poor people poorer. I'd argue that the think tanks probably are, or at least trying to cut anti-poverty programs. So, is there a partisan problem here? Are you measuring issue ownership ultimately, or are you measuring something else?
Yeah. So I think this is a case where overall members of Congress are not particularly active on poverty issues, right? When I look at it, you know, about 3/4 of members of Congress never sponsor a single bill related to poverty, even given that pretty broad definition that I use. So, you know, the first cut of this is to say that neither party is doing a lot. That said, it would be disingenuous not to recognize that there are party differences that come up here. And I think that this is a really interesting question about what is going on with Republican legislators, particularly from poor districts, right? Because there are a number of Republicans who represent rural poor mostly, and some suburban poor as well, and yet they're not as active there. I think as to, you know, whether this is capturing the party element to it or kind of a issue ownership for the Democrats, I think is a really interesting question. And I, you know, there has been some characterizations and kind of the way we talk about poverty that fits more with the Democratic identity. And that is certainly true, but particularly because poverty is not exclusively urban or kind of quote-unquote Democratic constituencies. It seems a place that there is space for both parties here, and that this would be a really valuable place for the parties to be able to come together in a kind of in a classic sense, right? Always log roll, kind of, you have, you know, urban poor may be more Democratic, rural poor may be Republican. Let's do something for everybody, and we all, you know, get the greater good.
I guess there's like a third option to represent the poor here that we didn't talk about, which is, I mean, I hate to say it this way, but a little bit of class warfare, right? I mean, is the problem that we don't have a social cleavage in the United States based upon economic issues? I think about that that Gillins and Page work, and there was a follow-up piece by Chris Flegen, Stu Soroka, and Alex Branham. And what they found was that the rich and the poor just don't disagree that much, or at least the middle class and the rich rarely disagree. There's very few issues in which they do, and they're not anti-poverty issues. So except there may be tax issues. So is there an opportunity out here for someone to come along, either a Republican or a Democrat, and really reshape American politics? I mean, are the votes there?
Yeah, that's a really great set of questions. So I'm going to try and keep them all in my head. No, this is fantastic. I mean, I think this, so to get at this question of whether there are a lot of differences across the classes, you know, I think that is a place where, as you mentioned, there's research that shows there aren't that much. However, there's also the other side, where some of the scholars, in fact, show that there is pretty significant difference of preferences across class. And so I think that, to me, is kind of an ongoing conversation. And obviously, it shapes kind of where you take the research next, depending on which of those, kind of which side of
we'll
that
you about
debate
that
you're on. Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, one of the things I would mention in the context of that is that some of that focuses on kind of general ideology or general disposition towards government, which is not what I'm looking at. And so if I take kind of your question in the context of my research here and thinking about these interests, there is just no way that there's not a difference here between interests, right? So the actual policies, you know, school lunch programs or Head Start or help for the homeless, those that they're that matters differently to the poor and economically insecure than it does to the middle class or to the rich. So I think I'll kind of sidestep some of the ongoing question about whether preferences and ideologies are different across classes and say that I think they're very real differences in the types of policies that directly affect us based on kind of where on the economic spectrum we are. The other thing I would say about this kind of question about class warfare, maybe spin it a little positively and then, you know, call it populism. I think this is really interesting. And just, you know, in the time I was working on this book, things shifted. So if we think about the 2016 election, right, you had Bernie Sanders, of course, on the left kind of talking a much more populist message. And on the right, if we look at the president's message when he was a candidate, it was also very populist. Now, whether or not that plays out in the actions legislators take is a separate question, but the rhetoric, I would say, in the last couple of years, and even going back earlier, right, if you think about some of the rhetoric in the early days of the Tea Party, you know, has a populist undercurrent to it. And so there is a real potential here to bring focus and for elected officials to see reason and benefit electorally to engaging these issues. And then if we think now about the 2018 midterms, you also see this, you know, surge of Democratic freshmen coming in, of more progressive Democrats having a louder voice, at least as the media is telling us so far. It remains to be seen what actually happens in Congress. But I think those all have the potential to shape the conversation and to refocus our attention on poverty and inequality. The caveat I would give is that I think if past is a guide here, sometimes these conversations tend to focus more on the 99% and the 1%. And that's really valuable, but the 99% isn't all the same. Or they tend to focus on middle class, right? And because as Americans, we have a tendency to all identify as the middle class. And so I think the caution here is to make sure that in any questions or debates about inequality, that the poor don't fall out of those conversations.
And you find that, you know, this is not an insignificant number of people, right? There are voters, in fact. It's not that the poor don't vote. It's not that there aren't enough poor people. It's that people aren't representing them. And so there definitely seems to be a missed opportunity there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's tens of millions of poor Americans. And, you know, that number fluctuates, of course, but it's a large number of people.
All right, so let's start wrapping this up. So where is this project going from here? I mean, you mentioned that things are changing. So I mean, I'm assuming that you're thinking about what the follow up is here, and how would you go about you know, measuring and understanding how things are changing?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the areas in which I'm working and extending kind of off of some of the ideas that came about through the book is actually focusing on the rural poor and focusing also on party and Republicans. And so taking a closer look again over time about how Republican activity has shifted in terms not just of the numbers, but also the types of bills when they are sponsoring anything, when they are doing things, focusing attention a little bit more on that, and also thinking much more about the balance of programs targeting rural poverty, urban poverty, suburban poverty, and then just the kind of overall poverty. So that's an area in which I'm continuing to look, because it really, as I said before, I don't want to give the impression that some poor are well represented. That is not the case. But the rural poor are especially underrepresented because of this partisan dynamic that we were just talking about. So that's an area that I continue to work in right now. The other thing that I think will be interesting, thinking kind of more about the current events going on, is how this new Congress and this next 2-year cycle takes up issues related more broadly to class and to taxation. So thinking about, for instance, the recent proposal that got a lot of attention about increasing the upper bracket to 70% tax rate. So that's not directly actually about poverty, right? It's, again, looking at that top 1%. But the implications of this, of having these conversations, and also how could those revenues then be used in other ways? And if the purpose of it is to address inequality, one would think that as that conversation develops, some of the resources and ideas that come from that could be used to address issues of poverty.
Do you think it's a coincidence that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents one of the poorest districts in the country?
I think there's both, right? So in some sense, there are exceptions to my general results that there is not a relationship. Now, that doesn't mean that it never happens, of course.
Or that's changing.
Yeah, right. So that could be part of it. I also think that this is a place where, to the earlier conversation, one's own experiences matter, right? So another place in which she brought attention was when she mentioned that she was not able to rent a place in D.C. until she got her paycheck because it was expensive. And that's true. You know, it really is. And so I think we're also, as we get greater economic diversity, perhaps, whether in this class or in future classes, and people bringing different personal experiences, that also helps because, you know, that gives a directness to certain policies, a familiarity with what that means to not have money to have two residences in two expensive cities or, you know, what have you. And so I think that's also an important part of what could change the conversation a bit.
This has been wonderful. Thank you. Before we go, we ask everybody to recommend a work of political science that you think that our listeners should listen to.
Oh, this is
not listen to.
This is a tough question. There's a lot of really great stuff out there, and I hesitate because I feel like anything I say, then as soon as we conclude, I'll
say,
"Oh."
Will you do my thing?
Come on. you know, it's been out for a couple of years, but kind of related to some of what we've been talking about. Jim Curry's book on legislating in the dark, on the politics of information and party control of information, I think, is a really important piece for people thinking about Congress, but also policymaking. And, you know, it comes to mind, particularly in light of the earlier part of our conversation, thinking about wanting to have more voices at the table. And so it's really important, thinking about poverty, that some of the proposals are going to be free market, and some are going to be about rural poverty, and some are going to be about minority poverty, and some are going to be, you know, progressive or socialist or what have you. But if we think about the quality of policy making, having information, having ideas, is a really important part of that. And so his book really speaks to how party leaders have shaped the information flows in ways that I think are really consequential.
Well, Christina, thank you for joining us. Emily, thank you for joining us.
Of
Everybody
course.
For listening. This has been your Policy Agendas podcast.